Today, we're talking to Frank DeGeorge, CTO at Impact Networking, about how he's evolving his team and company as a leader. You're listening to Joel Beasley, Modern CTO.
I'm curious. I was stalking you a little bit to see what's going on in Frank's life. So you guys seem to win amazing awards constantly for being a great place to work. That's a trend. Tell me about that.
You know, I've been, it's crazy because I was just telling the story to some of our new hires that started. I've been with the company 18 years almost, which to me is way too long. If from a timeline standpoint, it seems I'm not even old enough to be that person. And then way too fast from a reality standpoint, that a blink of an eye. You know, we've gone from 35 employees when I started to nearly 1,000. And we try really hard to make it a great place to be. You know, everything from our ownership to the top down. We do little things. We do big things. We do things that, you know, are individual. We do, you know, there's a lot of continuing education going on right now with some of our employees. I went through a class at Kellogg last year to kind of just level up my knowledge and trying to stay on top of things. But yeah, it's great. I think we just got our best places to work in Chicago. We're one of the fastest growing companies in Chicago. You can't have a great company without great people. And the bigger you get, it becomes harder to maintain that culture. But you got to work at it. And everything, like I said, from our owner, Frank Kuko, down, we really try and be communicative and clear, transparent, and give people the state of the union as it is.
Yeah. Well, that's why I enjoyed you guys. We did the first show together just off podcast. Then I got invited to speak at the Navy Pier event.
Yeah.
I think I got to meet Frank and maybe a son, or I think there were some family members around the business. And then you, of course. And it was good times. That's a pleasant memory in my mind of getting to interact with you guys.
That was a great event. And your presentation was well ranked. So we enjoyed that. We enjoyed you coming down. I'm glad we, you know, started that relationship with that worked out. Yeah, and Frank's son, I don't know if he was in the business then, but he's been in a few different roles. One of his sons, Anthony, and so him and I are close, and he's going through right now and learning different parts of the business, and bringing some experience, but also bringing some white belt mindset, right? We're coming in and trying to learn things how they are and figure out how we can make things easier and better for everybody.
Yeah, fresh perspective is always great. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about where you're spending your time today.
Well, I'll give you some basic numbers. So we were, I don't know if we have our final numbers from last year, we're about just at 200 million. If we didn't hit it, we'll be just shy of it. And so about 900 people. And when we talk about digital transformation and just transforming a company, a lot of times it's focused on the tech. And you and I have talked about this. And it's also about the business transformation that your company goes through. So not only are we growing, you know, 15 to 25% a year, not only are we embarking on, you know, trying to modernize our systems and keep up with the changes, but our core business has shifted in that same concept. And so what I mean by that, in the last 2 years, IT went from being about 50 million in revenue to being just over 105, you know, 110 last year. And so you pair
that
with
crazy.
Yeah. You pair that with the growth of the company, with the, you know, with the total revenue of the company and total employee count. So that's where my time has spent, is the things that even the decisions we made 3 or 4 years ago, which at the time were, you know, sound decisions, you're looking back now and you're questioning, was that the right decision? Should we have done some things differently? Hindsight's always 20/20, but you know, there's some things like, okay, well, we should have prepped for this better or planned for that better. You know, I don't look at it as mistakes. I look at it as an opportunity to learn and figure out, okay, let's change course if we need to. Let's put resources towards it. So all those things right now is what keeps me focused and honestly energized for the next 5 or 10 years.
How do you go from 110 million to 200 million in IT?
We'll do it. I mean, for we'll be well on our way to having that team keep up as growth. Now, there's some things that we need to work on in order to make sure that happens. So there are some you know, what started out as a workaround or an experiment supporting that business way back in 2015 when Patrick Layton, who you met at Optimize too, that event at Navy Pier, first started with us. So, like I said, the decisions then were support it, figure it out. Is it going to work? You know, 5-year contracts, managed services. A lot of these things were not new, but, you know, for the first time, you'd apply to that SMB market. And so we put tech in place that would support it and grow. And now those things that became workarounds, became core business processes, became products in some cases. And now we're looking back as like, okay, what level of core tech can we use to allow us to be innovative and agile, right? And I think we got caught up looking back at some of the things that made us innovative and agile, but those things became core products. And so when that happens, you have to spend a lot of time focusing on things that maybe you should be able to take for granted if you had a core system that was being maintained by somebody or by an organization like a Microsoft or ConnectWise or ServiceNow, versus trying to build some of that on your own. And so that's what we're working on right now, is figuring out what core can come in and take the place and allow the team of developers and business analysts and continuous improvement people focus on being agile and delivering more, I would say, better results to the company by automating more things and not focusing on just trying to keep up.
Yeah, that's, you know, I think we talked in 22 last, so it's a year and a half, 2 years ago or so.
Probably.
But yeah, what's going on with AI and GPT inside of your org? I mean, you guys do managed services, tons of human communication,
right?
Is AI assisting you in any of that?
Yes, but as people are trying to figure that out, they know that you have to be in the good spot with how your data is organized and what you're going to feed into AI systems. And that became even more clear with generative AI, right? Machine learning, yes, we already, you know, everyone's talked about that for years about, you know, you got to have the data, you got to have patterns, you got to be able to identify it, and that can be something that's more repeatable. When you start talking about generative AI, you really got to be, intentional about what you give it to frame the context around it. And there's a few things that we're working on with that. I break that out in like 4 different categories. If we want to go into all of that, we look at what platforms are built around AI and have that. What can we use as products like ChatGPT and Copy.ai and Otter and HeyGen is one we're using for quick video production. Then we have workflows and how they hit workflows within the business processes day to day. And then data, right? Big data, large data sets. How do I use that to, better project trends or better, have a chat assistant that it can access large data sets versus just a small subset of knowledge bases that we've allowed it to access. So all those things are kind of in play right now. And we're experimenting a lot and in some cases failing quickly and figuring out how do we use it better or, what's preventing us and what obstacles are in our way that we can then clear and then try again.
And what are you guys doing with Sixth Sense? Because I saw them a while back. They came up the other day in a conversation I was having off the podcast about someone was having success using their intent data.
Yeah.
And then I saw it come up in the interview prep for you. So I was like, what are you doing with Sixth Sense?
So I would put that more in the platform, part of AI, that their core platform is based on machine learning models and data coming from a few different aspects. So we just started with them this year. We're actually not even in our live yet. We're in our pre-live kind of, they call it the Tiger team, right? So we have our first set of reps and managers and sales reps going in there right now and seeing what's there. But we gave it essentially 2 years of data from our CRM. We gave it a year or so from our HubSpot and marketing automation data, Google Analytics, and a few other things. And what it does is based on the data you have, the activities, the opportunities, traffic coming to your website, and a whole bunch of other things, they bring it together and then they try and compare that or they build a model around that. And then they compare that to data coming in more real time, right? So who's kind of visiting our website, who's researching us. And that's one of the biggest things I think that they have an advantage. They curate a lot of their own data from publications. So we can actually go in and see who's reading about impact in, a write-up about Impact Optimize or whatever, or who's, And so they have relationships with millions of other different publications and websites that they kind of feed that data in and then give it back to us in their platform. And by reviewing the patterns that have happened in the past and comparing the things that are happening today, then we could say that this company is interested in XYZ. You know, in any given market, even if we have, let's say, 300 ideal customer profiles or ICPs, as we call them, in that territory, 95% of them are not going to be ready for what we have to offer. And we do a lot of education as part of our process, right? It's becoming easier. Like, I think companies know they need to help with cybersecurity and managing IT, but we do a lot of education about what it actually takes to do that, right? So finding that other 5%, if they're interested and are finding us, that we can raise that alert in sixth sense and then have a rep or an SDR reach out to them at that point in time, continue that education process with them. That's what we're hoping for to yield some success, is to just find those, even a couple per team or territory every quarter could make the difference.
Yeah, when I was talking with Dominic, who has a company called 2X, and this is the conversation I was having with him off the podcast about the intent data, and he had said, like, at any given point in time, 1-3% of your market's like actually ready to buy, and then the other, and he goes, what he sees a lot, and what we were doing, because I was asking him for tips on how to get better privately, and what we were doing is we just blast out a ton of just generalized content emails and cast a wide net. And we didn't have a strategy to target our strategy was just cover the entire market. Make sure everybody who's in market hears our name constantly. And while that works, to know that there's another strategy you can deploy in parallel, that is create content for the 1-3% of the people who are moving right now, and then identify them and focus the content towards them. It just sounds stupid to not do that after you learn that that's an option.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And coming from where we came from, right, copy and print world, the company started in 1999. We sold copiers and printers, did some block of time network services because we had to, because they plugged into the network. And in 99, that was like a new thing. You know, go back, 25 years, and that was just it was on the news, like, oh, this copier that can also scan and print, like it was revolutionary. So that is a more of a spray approach, right? You know, it's like, okay, we'll throw it out there, everybody needs it, they know they need it, and then you can go and find your opportunities. As you get more refined, and as we say, okay, well, the managed IT service or the cyber service, like, that's not for everybody, right? You have to be willing to invest in technology. In most cases, you can't just be a small 5-person office, right? You because that you can do on your own now, right? With Microsoft Cloud, Google Cloud, you don't really need a lot of help. It's really that mid-size market. So what started out as a spray approach, then we started to kind of refine that, and we defined our ICP and said, like, this is who we're going to go after, this is how we're going to go after, and these are the people that we want to go after. These are the industries that fit the most. And then you start to, then you start to define the market. And like you said, then there's a very small piece of that actually is ready, that is ready to listen, that is ready to engage in the sales process, be educated, and eventually pull the trigger on something that they know they need help with, and they don't realize what it takes to actually do it properly.
Do you think that we're going to see a rise in in-person events and in-person business as the AI becomes really good at deep faking or creating digital twins?
100%. We've already seen, we shoot for in-person meetings first and foremost. I think they're more effective. I think people like them better. Yes, we're doing this remotely. It's convenient, right? But I think overall, in-person events become more productive. You put an interesting spin on it. We have a platform, HeyGen, which I can record a video myself for 2 minutes, right? And I actually did this at the all company meeting and didn't tell anybody. And then we played a video, and everyone's like, he looks a little off, or he sounds a little bit off, but they're like, maybe it's just the camera or the delay and the stream, and not until the end of the video did I come out and say that this was completely generated by AI with an AI script. And it took me about, besides the recording, now I can go back in there I can go to ChatGPT, make my script, put it in there, and I can make me say anything, right? Mm-hmm. And that's real, and people aren't really going to know the difference anymore. So I think, yeah, from a security standpoint, that's an interesting approach that people will lean more towards those types of in-person events and meetings, because you may not very quickly be able to determine what is real and not real. And I think that is a challenge. That's something that's got to be figured out. It's not going to slow us down in the meantime, right? I think the whole market has to figure that out first and foremost.
100%. Yeah. I don't like ever letting fear slow you down or distract you in that sense. I'm just curious, like from a macro level, right? Because I have these high level conversations constantly. And I see that there's going to be this rise in the ability to authenticate that I'm real and this is happening in real time.
Right.
And that technology hasn't happened yet. The closest thing we've got is the blue check mark. That, you know, right? It's but to validate it, and so you know the content's coming from me, and you not only do you know it's coming from me, but you know it's actually me. Yeah, I think those bonds. I think there's going to be a rapid improvement in the next 2 to 5 years with being able to fake yourself actually being there, and I think that's going to push us farther into in-person relationships.
Yeah. To put this in perspective, when I did my course at Kellogg, I think I was done with it last summer. So it was it was last June and the year before that. And it was a chief digital officer program. Generative AI was talked about maybe this much as part of a year-long class on chief digital officers. I even took an AI marketing, you know, elective as part of it, and design thinking and, you know, other things. So it's just, that's the perspective. Like even the best university, one of the best universities with the best professors talking about this, didn't see how quickly that was going to change the, you know, reality of what's going on, because there was only a very small piece of it. In fact, as part of one of my final projects I did there, I used ChatGPT and I disclosed that I used it. And I honestly, I was a little concerned that they may frown upon that because it wasn't really blessed as like, oh yeah, you can do it or not. But I did it just because it's like, hey, you know what? This is stuff that we're going to have to be working with. So I did that in November of when ChatGPT first launched, you know, so I think it was November, right? I mean, my timeline might be a little off, but I think it was November when they first kind of dropped out and said, oh, you can now talk to this generative AI thing via chat. And so, yeah, I know we're getting a little off topic there, but it's just interesting how fast it changed. And one of the things I just put on LinkedIn yesterday, actually, my daughter really wants a chinchilla, right? A pet. And so she sent me screenshots of her on her iPad. And she's 8, by the way, of her on her iPad asking ChatGPT how to convince her mom or dad on what and how to get a chinchilla, what the requirements are. Is it a low maintenance pet, right? And so you can see her line of questioning, and she sent it to me and she goes, are you thinking about it now? And I'm like, I'm super proud of you for finding out how to do all this. So it's going to be in our day to day, and things have to adapt and change. But yeah, not to be cliche, it's not going away, but even my 8-year-old is using it on a day to day basis.
Yeah. My daughter is almost 7. And she hasn't gotten into that yet, but they have learned to do something similar to that behavior with talking to Alexa.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just because I haven't enabled her to do the ChatGPT thing yet. She just started reading about 6 months ago, like fluently on her own. And so, yeah, I'm curious to see. I've never even thought about that. Now you've got a new question. My wife and I tonight at dinner, Frank, we're going to be talking about when it's okay to introduce our kids to GPT.
Right.
It'll probably be like YouTube, where like we have certain apps where we let the kids watch whatever they want, whenever they want, because they're like apps that we believe in and they're moderated content. But then there's like YouTube or there's like a show they want to watch, like Ryan or something like that. And they're only allowed to watch YouTube with us. So it might be that type of situation where you could do ChatGPT with us. Yeah, for now.
Supervised ChatGPT.
Supervised. GPT for kids. I don't know if they have one yet, but they should. Yeah.
Not a bad idea, actually.
I know. There we go. But speaking to your point of you detecting it early, I had seen some projects. So everything popped off in February of last year with the general MSNBC, Fox, the mainstream people, my grandma knowing what GPT was type deal, popped off in like January, February. And they definitely released many versions, even multiple years ago, they had released versions to like senators and different people in legislative affairs so they could understand what was going on. But I had been following this and looking to monetize it because I've been following LLMs for like 7 or 8 years.
Yeah.
And I found, and so I saw it progressing, you know, from the bad image, like it wasn't creating good images. It was very sketchy, not good. And then just watching it have leaps and bounds. And so right around that end of the year timeframe, probably 2 or 3 months before it popped off, I saw this opportunity and I messaged an investor at my company and I was like, hey, he's one of the directors of Florida Funders. They're like a large VC firm. Mm-hmm. I said, pay attention to this because I don't know if it's a year out from everybody figuring it out or 2 years out or 6 months, but this is going to be huge. And here's a couple example applications of how you'd be able to use it. And for me, I was specifically interested in using it for storytelling. So I could put in a book and then it could continue that book with subsequent versions and then create video to illustrate that book. And now you're essentially creating movies from books through AI. I was like, that's one use, you know, a couple other things. And so I pushed that text to him and he was just like, thumbs up. And then like 6 months later, when it's all out in the news, we were talking, he's like, oh my gosh. He's like, yes, I remember you saying that. He goes, that's unbelievable. And now there's startups that are doing that, continuing the books. And so you can continue the stories, even if the writers are gone, there's mm-hmm. people turning it into video. And there's about a million other applications of this generative AI and GPT out there.
Yeah. You know, and for companies like us, where we have a few different groups that are kind of, I don't want to say playing, but experimenting, right? Trying to figure out what the business value is in day-to-day workflow. And that was one of the things that I wrote down as far as like the platforms are, you know, we're trying to figure out, yes, we can chat and everyone can chat or you can use Copilot and it can draft emails, but how do I actually put it into day-to-day business workflows? And that's something that we're working on right now to figure out, right? Can I take this and bring it down and then reference it as an LLM and then bring it back and then do this with it, interpret it, and then bring it back as part of a process. And for us, I think we got to be careful with all the startups. Not that I want to discourage startups and that, but you know, if it's going into a major business processes, we almost like have to choose a core, you know, one of the bigger platforms that we know is going to be around for a little bit, because some of these startups are going up and down and being bought and sold, you know, left and right. You know, for the experimental ones, like we're okay with that. But as we look at things to, you know, put out to our customers and engage in customer experience, we're actually looking at something, you know, like an IBM Watson or stuff mm-hmm. that we're doing on Azure with Microsoft's Azure AI services and stuff like that. Because there's going to be a bunch of things that bubble up, and I think some of them are going to get absorbed. Some of them are going to take off, right? Like OpenAI did, and some aren't, you know, but it's interesting to see what the creativity is happening with all these different startups to see what actually takes place, and what ideas that all these different companies can bring to the table.
Well, you're exactly right. So I've gotten involved in some decentralized AI projects, because there's going to be legislation around the models and the legality of them and they'll mean intelligence. So there's a whole push of people in the crypto blockchain world that are making AI decentralized so that they're just available in public and kind of out there and you can't get rid of them, right? But through that, I've gotten some really interesting experience in AI. And you're exactly right. The things will boom and burst, the market will shake up. And so for you as a business, you know, that's makes sense why you go with Sixth Sense, right? They are one of the leading brands. They're known for being the highest quality product and like more expensive, but it's good. And so that would make sense for you guys to go with someone like that.
Yeah. You know, and we're working with a small company now that seems to be a unique approach of how they put generative AI and AI content in a workflow. And I know Zapier has, you know, the GPT plugin, stuff like that is, you know, it has that as like a base level, but also the way that it can bring in data in your environment, keep it isolated. So you're not just throwing it out there in other random platforms. It kind of keeps it centralized, and you can bring your data at different points along the way and follow it along a workflow. So I can actually build prompts over time as part of a workflow to take something that may start as an Excel file that may be interpreted, that may go and then be analyzed and then spit out a report in an email that says, this is what you want. And it's three or four different prompts accessing different data along the way to get a final result. Those are the things that I'm really looking forward to, because that's how I start operationalize it, besides giving everybody a new chat friend in their email, you know, with Copilot to make email generation faster or understand meetings that they forgot to, you know, to do takeaways on.
Yeah, and I've played and programmed some of these models, and it seems to me, now I'm not that experienced, it's not my full-time job, I just armchair style, right? But it seems that they're really good at exactly what you talked about, training, like making an instance of it and training it to do like one very specific thing. And then having a bunch of those, or basically like a bunch of scripts or macros of GPTs, of things that this GPT is specialized really good at doing this thing, maybe combining CSVs and cleaning them up.
Right.
And if you try to keep teaching it more things, it seems to get a little wonky. So I've just not tried to fix that and instead just said, I'm just going to move forward with having these narrow intelligence. Oddly enough, neural networks and large language models are based off of humans' work, and that's exactly how we utilize humans, right? they're specialists in this one or two specific things. And so I said, well, that all makes sense. So the next layer is the routing layer, the GPTs that are going to get really, really, really good at figuring out what your intent is and where to route that to. And you can see the early stages of those routing GPTs inside of OpenAI system with the plugin store. They figure out where to route the request. So yeah, I've also noticed that because of what you said, all this churn and all this movement in the market and all this advancements with these tools, that most of the devs I'm talking to that run projects are intentionally building their systems to be as agnostic to the underlying LLM as humanly possible. And they can switch their models dynamically. Let's give this set to OpenAI, see how it responds. Let's give this one to, you know, this other model over here. And have you seen that too?
Yeah, more and more. In fact, the one that I was referencing that we're kind of experimenting with right now, you can choose really almost, I would say, any LLM, right? But there's probably five or six that they can work with outside of GPT-4, 3.5, right? And so on and so forth. So yeah, I do think that is going to happen as these other organizations, especially larger ones like Google and Apple. I read an article at Apple today, released a research paper yesterday on actually figuring out how AI can actually sense the resolution of your screen. I'm not sure if you saw that, right? But it can actually start interacting with content on the screen based on what's there. So that can be super interesting, especially if you consider that the target probably is the iPhone, of what they're working on as they release the next set of AI tools. But on the LLM side, I think, yeah, it's too early to tell what's going to, you know, now they're talking about, you know, small language models and stuff like that. So I think, depending on the use case, and I think you're going to start seeing really specialized LLMs, right? I think you already start to see that a little bit.
Yeah, it's just moving so fast. There's a couple of them that are now small enough, you know, you can, like Llama, and you can run it on your computer. If you have I put it on my MacBook. Like I have a 3 or 4 year old MacBook, pretty slow, but on my Mac Studio, that thing was just as fast as GPT. Yeah.
Yeah, we looked at some of the offline ones that we can run ourselves, but try not to do that right now, honestly.
Well that's a whole skill set. You'll have to bring in a whole employee just to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't think it's any easier or less expensive to run once you get on your own environment, because you're probably running it someplace in the cloud. And, you know, unless I have a bunch of Mac Studios that I'm buying to do it, right? So, yeah, that stuff we're still figuring out. But for the most part, we're using more or less private data sets with cloud-based, you know, tools.
What's the most effective use and application that has occurred with your business in relation to these AIs or LLMs?
Well, I would say is one that we're working on now, and we're looking at a few different platforms. One of them is IBM Watson. We're really not working with them directly yet, but that is something we're putting as a in between customer submitting tickets and problem tickets into our service desk, and then getting a knowledge base response based on what the ticket says versus what we say the process should be to do X, Y, and Z. And so that's what I said, you know, before, that you can't just give it, I think I mentioned this, but you can't just give it, you know, 5 or 10 years of ticket history, right? Because you're gonna get a lot of noise there. So cleaning the data and using a knowledge base and then using and tweaking it for what AI expects it to be and defining clear problem statements with clear resolutions that things are documented properly, that is what gonna yield probably the best results with that. So we can give customers more access to the basic questions that they ask and then our spin on it, right? Like, how do you reset a password? Well, you know, on your computer, you do it this way. If you have Azure or Office 365, you do it this way. If you don't have any of those, you do it this way. And so pairing with what that customer is asking, who that customer is, and what the response is on the knowledge base and delivering that back to somebody for a quicker response than we can give when they just submit a ticket. So,
and you have a human kind of monitoring the outcomes of that and saying if it's good or bad, like fine tuning.
We will, yeah, especially as we get started, right? We got to see how that works, how that gets handled. So those are things that we're working on now that I think could, you know, obviously help increase customer experience and customer service and make it easier for us to support that customer.
One of the things that I like about you that I rank you as high competency, one of the things that you do is whenever I'm talking with you, you have the high level business understanding, but you also have the way you speak, you can tell that you've had hands on the keyboard and like played with the tools. How do you functionally do that? Do you just see something cool and you're like, I need to know this, put 2 hours in my calendar to like dive deep into it? Or are you going in side saddling with an engineer who knows how to do that and having them walk you through it? Like, what's your actual process for getting your operator time in?
It's funny you mentioned that because I was just making fun of myself to a couple of my developers and one of our managers and directors on how I feel like I'm losing some of that because, you know, there's so much going on that we're trying the plan and the roadmap and what gets attention, what gets priority, and listening on calls to make sure we stay on track and listening for roadblocks or things that people understand one way, but in reality is another way. You know, I just... for many years in the field when I was in sales, I did a lot of hands-on demos, right? I didn't rely on anybody to build what I needed to do when I was demoing things to customers or customizing demos or the workflow and logic. I was a horrible coder, you know, in fact, so much so in college that I wish we had low code when I went to college because I would have loved that. I would have been able, because the logic is sound, right? I can do that. I can do, you know, I was very good at that stuff, but I hated the syntax. I didn't have the attention to detail for that type of thing, and it didn't interest me. But solving business problems with tech and logic and workflows, that's where I really did the best, and I did that for 15 years in front of customers. So, you know, I need to make sure I keep up with that so I can maintain that skill set and not just rely on what got me to where I'm at, even though I do a little bit. But it's harder for me to spend the time more and more doing that. But I read a lot. I listen to podcasts. I read. I listen to your podcast.
Yeah. Do you really?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you, man.
I try and not all the time. So don't.
I've done 1,000 episodes. I don't expect.
Don't start quizzing me, right? But I have it. But let me change it. I have listened to your podcast.
There we go. No, Frank's an active listener. Yeah, he listens to one episode at least every year.
But I get in and I try to understand like when our engineers are stuck or developers are stuck or business analysts stuck, why we're stuck and how do we get past it? And ultimately it comes down to why we're doing things and why we're stuck and why we're trying to solve it this way and not a different way. And so all those things together, I think just, yeah, I mean, I've had the on-hands experience and I try and maintain a level of that.
So let's give a shout out to Dot Security. We might as well do some work here, Frank.
Sure.
If you have needs, what are the people's needs when they're like, I'm having a need, Dot Security might be the answer. What is that?
So with the way that, IT has changed, you know, not to sound cliche, but especially rounding from COVID on, you know, to the years after, it was a monumental shift of how companies operated, right? We still had companies going in to the office because their VPNs weren't set up or they had a local system. Like, you know, things have come a long way with different cloud apps and how we use, you know, Teams and Slack and all these things to share and collaborate. You know, companies that didn't have a document management system, you don't have a choice, right? The invoices and POs and everything are coming in, and I usually print them out to match up with this. And so that fundamentally forced people to change. And so as the pandemic was rounding, you know, or, you know, heading in the right direction, we definitely saw the challenge to our customers. And so Patrick Layton and Jeff Leader was really that kind of their minds together that came together and said that we need to focus on this. And because we've been providing cybersecurity services for years, right? And, you know, separating the operational components from the cyber components, because everybody needs operational IT if you're a mid-sized organization. You need to be able to have the expertise in patching and backup and network and firewalls and cloud security and databases, servers, Cisco, you name it, right? On you go, Meraki, whatever tech it is, you need to have expertise. And it's really not feasible for one organization to have those expertise. So you work with a company like Impact that has, I don't know, 200-300 engineers with expertise in every one of those fashion. And so you can really come in and be operationally well-run from an IT standpoint. Now, that doesn't mean that you're safe from everything, right? That you still have to have, you know, there's things that you have to do right, like backups and verify backups and do, you know, like we use KnowBe4 for phish testing and, you know, and seeing who's going to click on the email. Because you give the best environment in the world. If you click the email, type in their password, right? People are still the problem. So the next phase of that with DOT was to put more advanced protections in place around threat protection or endpoint protection, and then really monitoring environments for changes. And it's not just tech, right? Because in our SOC, we get, I forget the number. It's either a billion a day or a billion a week or multiple billions of alerts coming to the SOC. And we put hands on a couple hundred of them. So it's really refining what that is in that environment and improving the security posture over time. Because then the next level of just having the tech handle and having someone review the SOC alerts is then what are you okay as a business and what risk are you accepting in order to conduct the business the way you are? And I'll give you just an easy example of that. Like we have a call every week, right? And so we have four security calls a month, right? Two of them are tactical, which means we're reviewing the risk register. Like, what are things that we find at risk? Are we accepting it? Who's in charge of it? Is there a project associated with it? And who's really tracking it to make sure that happens? And then the other one is more of a strategy call. What are we not doing today? What can we be experimenting with? What new platforms are out there with AI for mail protection and spam protection, right? How do we keep that? Keep that on the cutting edge. And so we review that. And then the risk register, like there's an old application that we ran that had plain text passwords in the database, right? A basic no-no. It wasn't being updated. The company that made it has acknowledged it and had no plans to fix it. As a business, we got to say, are we accepting that risk or not? Because it's going to come up every time that they scan and see plain text passwords that are being exchanged between the application. And so it takes a human interaction to say, yes, we accept it. We scramble the passwords every month. It can't be, you know, they have to be 16 characters, right? It's not used that often and we can isolate it. And so just things like that, that you increase the posture over time of the security environment. And you can do that for lots of things within your organization. And so a risk register may have a couple hundred items on it or a few hundred items on it for a customer. That's managed by a person, right? Not by a platform, not by a, well, there is platforms and software that help us manage it, all right? But it's about interactions with that organization and improving that over time, following basics like CIS controls and making sure that we're crossing off the boxes and figure out how far along those controls it makes sense for that organization. And then not to get completely, you know, off on a tangent here, but then you got compliance and companies that are in the supply chain for the defense, you know, different defense agencies and whatnot. And that spawns a whole nother world of conversation. And we haven't even talked about checking the box for cybersecurity insurance yet or cyber insurance yet. So that's why companies are starting to realize that they need help with it.
Nice.
There's a lot there.
Dot security, DOT security. That if you guys need help with the security managed services, that's where you go.
And I hope I did it justice and Patrick doesn't call me up and said that
Patrick's
going to
call you up.
Yeah, he's going to say, well, you didn't say this right, or that's, you know, this is that way. And so.
Awesome, Frank. We did it. We made a podcast. Yes. How do you feel?
I feel good. It's good to talk with you, Joel.
It's always good to talk with you. Whenever I see your name come up on my calendar, I smile. I'm like, I told my wife, I'm talking to Frank today. He's good people.
Thank you so much for listening. And if you found this episode useful, please share it with a friend or a colleague who you think would get value from it. And if you have topics that you'd like to hear discussed on the podcast, either add me on LinkedIn or send me an email, joel@moderncto.io. Every time I get an email or a LinkedIn message, it absolutely makes my day and inspires me to keep going.